This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by Jonathan Courtney, an expert in design sprints, to talk about how they can be used to engage stakeholders and kickstart cultural change. This week's podcast is sponsored by Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and on this week's show we have, as normal, the wonderful Marcus Ellington. Hello Marcus.
Hello Paul, how are you? This lovely summer's evening.
Oh, it's gorgeous, isn't it? Absolutely stunning.
We shouldn't be stuck inside recording, should we? We should be sunbathing or something, I don't know.
I have to say, I don't feel like I'm stuck inside.
Because you've got the doors open, yeah.
I've got my big bay window bifold doors open and it's all lovely and super and smashing and life is good.
Lovely. I can't hear any birds tweeting though.
Well, that's because I have such a good mic and I've got such a professional setup here that I've avoided all those kinds of problems.
Okay.
So, yes, how are you?
I'm fine. I've got a busy week coming up. I'm going to be speaking at a conference later in the week.
Ooh, what are you speaking on?
I'm speaking with Jane from Birkbeck University about the user journey mapping we did with them. And I'll talk about the user journey mapping and why user journey mapping is a good thing. And then she'll talk about how the actual work that we did with them benefited them. So and it's a conference called Content Ed. So education related content.
Yes.
Thingy.
Yes, I was quite envious you were at that one. That looked very good. Looked like a good conference.
I will report back.
Okay. Whether it gets your approval.
Yeah.
You can't go along to it and schmooze everyone and then come back on the podcast and slag it off. That wouldn't be very PC,
You know that's not going to happen. I'm going to say I like everything and everyone. So
that is true.
It's great. Brilliant. But Chris would have done this one because I didn't do the work with Birkbeck. So I'm sort of having to stand in. There's a little bit of a story here because obviously you and Chris worked with the Birkbeck people on that particular project. And so I had nothing to do with it, didn't really know the people at all, didn't know the project. And Chris and Jane were talking, wouldn't it be great if we could do a little story, do it at IWMW, and then that kind of, what came out of that is the Content Ed one and the Engaging Networks conference. Mm. Chris was meant to do the Engaging Networks one, and then he suddenly had to go to a funeral, so I had to jump in 2 days before.
Yeah.
This one, he's selfishly gone on holiday. So I'm imagining that some horrible illness will befall him for IWMW, and I'll be speaking at that one as well.
He is terrible. He always comes up with a way of getting out of it. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah. He really doesn't like doing public speaking. I mean, neither do I particularly, but he likes it a lot less than I do. So, so I reckon it's all just excuses.
I do as well. I couldn't agree more. In fact, I would go as far as pretty much guaranteeing that it's excuses. But to be honest, I can't blame him because I don't understand why anybody who is afraid of public speaking ever does it. I've said this before that for me, it's not something that worries me at all. And it was when I was first chairing a conference and I was sitting at the back of stage. And it was the first time it really even occurred to me that people didn't really like public speaking. And there were all these people. Well, I knew some people didn't. But the idea that there were people that hated it but would do it anyway just hadn't entered my mind. And sitting at the back of this stage and seeing all these people so nervous and then go on and do an amazing job and being brilliant speakers. And I was thinking, I wouldn't do it. If I got nervous about it, I just wouldn't do it. Well, simple as that.
Yeah, there's two sides to that, though. One, in our case, we feel that we really ought to, you know, kind of wave our flag a bit more than we are. And that kind of forces you to do it. But there's that kind of at the end of a performance, it might be music, you might be in a play, whatever. If you were really nervous beforehand, I think you get even more of a buzz afterwards.
Yeah, that's true. So I do get that.
So if you do it once and it came off well, then you want to repeat that feeling, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But
I still don't really want to do it, but I'll do it. I'll do my bit.
Yeah, you're fine at it as well. You do a perfectly adequate job in the times that I've seen you do it. Actually, I say that,
thanks,
I can't remember.
Adequate, that's a nice word, isn't it?
Do you know, I don't like to lie, Marcus. Do you know, I honestly, the real truth is, I can't remember ever seeing you do public speaking. I must have.
Yeah, it's a fairly rare thing, but I have done it every now and then. I can't. Yeah. Now my mind's gone blank. I've never done it ever before. This is the first time, apart from when I did it a couple of months ago.
Well, of course, the other thing is when I was at Headscape, I always got lumbered. Well, not lumbered with it because I didn't mind doing it. But yeah. So, you know, I would have done most of them.
Exactly.
I'm sure you'll be brilliant. I'm every confidence in you, Marcus.
Thank you, Paul.
I bet you're a very kind of relaxed, chilled out kind of speaker, aren't you?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I want to try and make them laugh, which I sometimes I can manage.
Yeah, it very much, but that's a very unpredictable one. That depends as much on the audience and the venue and who speaks before you.
Exactly.
It's very hard to get them going if it's the wrong kind of atmosphere.
Lots of stony faces in the audience.
Well, sometimes it's not even stony. Sometimes it's just kind of, I'm exhausted. There have been too many talks. My brain has turned to mush. That's quite a common one.
I have got the after lunch slot, but it's on day one. So hopefully it won't be too
bad.
Not too
bad. Yeah. No, that's all right.
Yeah.
So what's your thought for the day? Is it about customer journey mapping by any chance?
It's not actually, no. I have to confess to being a little bit busy and therefore I've been a bit lazy and I've dug out an old post. But it's a subject that I kind of deliberately wrote about because it's something that's a little bit contentious. So
And also, how many times have I been going on this podcast and elsewhere about how important it is to reuse content?
Exactly.
You know, that's good marketing. You know, good, you know, content marketing is the idea of reusing stuff again and again. Mm. So absolutely go for it. That's why I thought you were going to be talking about customer journey mapping for the same reason.
Well, we'll save that. But I didn't think of that, Paul.
No, you could use that. You could use that after you've done the content, Ed.
Afterwards, yes. That was an excuse to talk about it again. But anyway, no, this one is, the title of the post is, Are Carousels or Sliders or Galleries or whatever you want to call them that bad? Really?
Oh, that's just a good one.
Right. So, because I just thought, you know, it's been years of us saying to clients, you really don't want these things for these various reasons. And but, you know, I'm going to exaggerate to make the point, but 9 out of 10 websites have them.
Yeah.
So I'm like thinking, well, then therefore, the rest of the world seems to like them. So I thought, well, let's have a little an investigative look into what they're all about and are they that bad really. So as I said, I spent years saying to our would-be clients or actual clients that they're not a good thing. People don't, you know, studies show that people don't like any things that animate, it annoys them, they don't go past the first slide, they don't interact with the first slide, so why bother having more than one, etc., etc. And do you really want to be having this tool on your homepage that's just really for kind of internal politics and make sure that, you know, everybody who comes to you says, you know, I want my stuff on the homepage, well, we can hide it in the carousel. And that was the first thing that I thought, well, why isn't that a thing? Why isn't dealing with internal politics necessarily a thing that you might want to deal with on your homepage? Is it not, you know, if a carousel can provide a method to hide that content, then that's a legitimate reason to have one, maybe. Obviously, it shouldn't be distracting from your main objectives for your website, but if it does that job and it does it quietly, then why is that a bad thing? Was my first point.
Yeah, it's taking, what you're doing there is taking a pragmatic view of it.
Yeah.
And that's why carousels are so common, because it's a pragmatic, easy problem to an internal politics. But if I may be devil's advocate, and what you're saying there, but it's papering over a problem. It's not actually fixing the internal politics problem, is it? It's just covering it up, and it's covering it up potentially at the cost of the user of a distraction and annoyance or whatever.
Yeah, the large caveat there was that it mustn't, you know, it mustn't get in the way of other more important objectives. But you know, it's still a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Right. So my next point was: are these things becoming a convention? You know, because of their prevalence, is do users go to, and I don't know the answer to this, but these are potential questions. Do users go to website and say, I'm on an e-commerce site, this is where I'll find the latest offers. Or I'm on a company mm-hmm. website, this is where I'll find the latest news. I'm on a tourism site, this is where I'll find the lovely photos. Now, if that's true, then should we not be providing these tools that people are expecting to find this particular content in?
I haven't got the answer to that one because I don't know, like you said, I don't know whether that is true.
Mm.
I can understand the logic of it, however.
Yeah.
I'm resisting the urge to hit your head repeatedly against the table.
I'll move on to an actual example. So I mentioned tourism sites and pictures, right?
Yeah.
So let's say I'm thinking on going on a once-in-a-lifetime trip to somewhere like New Zealand, the other side of the world, and I'm going to be there for 2 months or whatever, and it's going to be fabulous, all that kind of thing. Now, of course, anyone doing that is going to carry out some research online.
Yes.
And I would certainly want to see some of the pictures of the wonderful scenery.
Yes.
Now, I could obviously visit a site that's got a big gallery of gorgeous mm-hmm. images, but A, I'd probably have to link to that from the homepage that I've just landed on from Google, and or scroll down that page to see all the images, neither of which is a big deal. I'm not saying mm-hmm. that this is a huge usability issue, but what if it's just there in front of me animating uh-huh. these wonderful images one after another? I don't have to do anything. So surely that's a better user experience than not having the carousel.
That one I utterly agree with. But then I wouldn't call that a carousel.
It's it's a gallery, isn't it?
It's a gallery or a slideshow. A carousel in my head is information that has been, well, I suppose you could argue that a photograph is information. Mm. Yeah, we're getting into the realms of semantics a little bit there.
Yeah.
But you're entirely right. That's a perfectly valid use of carousel. But don't you think this is like all things, that there is no definitive answer to this stuff? You can't ever say, you know, I can't even, I'm just trying to think of the thing that I most hate on the internet. It would have been capture at one point, but now it's pop-up overlays, right?
Well, or auto-playing videos.
Or auto-playing videos. You can't say with any of those things that they're always, always, always bad.
Yeah, and I think that's my whole point here. It's like maybe sometimes we should be considering these things as valid additions to a website. And I think that they've just got such a bad press that people just people like us automatically say, oh, no, we shouldn't have those. That's the whole point here.
Well, I can go back, being the old wrinkly that I am, and yourself equally old and wrinkly. You know, I can remember when animated GIFs were always bad. There was never an occasion when you would use an anime. And an even better example, I remember going to At Media 2005 and having this young upstart, Jeremy Keith stand on the stage and say JavaScript was a good thing.
Yes.
You know, and at the time that was like blasphemy.
Yeah.
You know, JavaScript was what did, well, pop-up overlays, actually, and annoying things. You know, you didn't use JavaScript.
But it was also all added in line as well, and he was, making the point that if you deal with it properly, then it's a fabulous tool.
But that's exactly the point that you're making here, that if you use it properly, it's a fabulous tool. And that's the true, whether you're talking about a carousel, capture, I don't know. I can't think of a good situation for capture. But, you know, with any of these things, there's a time and a place. That's what we're trying to say.
Yeah. And as long as you deal with all the accessibility issues and you make sure that, as I've already said, you're not getting in the way of more important objectives for a site, then it might be something that is actually valid. So that's my thought
Absolutely.
For the day.
Absolutely. That's a good one. I've enjoyed that one, Marcus. Cool. You got me quite enthusiastic. Not that I have any intentions of using a carousel.
No,
actually,
me neither.
That's a lie. I've got a carousel on my site.
Have you?
I do. Mm. If you go to boagworld.com/about, I have it's got a load of photographs that people download of me for, you know, headshot type stuff that people need. So I use it there.
There you go.
Exactly. Cool. Right. Talking about carousels. Here we go. This is going to be a really dodgy link. Talking of carousels, One of the wonderful drag and drop tools you get in Balsamic is the ability to drag in a carousel. And in fact, it has all of those kinds of UI components you could ever want, from carousels to calendars and everything in between. Wow, that was slick.
Yes. You are such a pro, as I've said before.
I know. So Balsamic is supporting this season, as always. Wonderful that they are too. And it, as I've said many, many times before, it's one of the easiest, or is the easiest, in my opinion, wireframing tool out there, with this amazingly bad. Sorry, Balsamic. Yeah, Freudian slip, maybe. No, not at all. It's the easiest to use wireframing tool, with the lowest barrier of entry. I was trying to say barrier and it came out as bad. That you can possibly get, which means that anybody can use it. It's great for discussions, it's great for testing, it's great for iteration, because you can just, you know, throw stuff together really, really quickly. And because it's got all these UI components, you just drag onto the screen. If you need a carousel, you drag a carousel on. And so it's great for selling ideas to the team that you're working with, without doing a lot of work. It's also great for putting together a quick prototype you want to test with. So if you're a little bit unsure of an idea, you don't spend hours, you know, mock-up in Sketch or whatever. You just throw something together in Balsamic and put it in front of users. Maybe you've got a few different ideas of different directions you could go. You can easily throw all of them together. It kind of competes with pen and paper. You know, it's not there to compete with InVision or Marvel or any of these prototyping tools. It is a wireframing tool for creating very quick and dirty, and it actually looks shit, and intentionally so. It's made to look like it's been drawn, and the reason that they've done it like that is because they know it sets stakeholders' expectations about what they're looking at. They don't think they're looking at a final design. But they've also found, when it comes to usability testing, that if they make it look like pen and paper, if they make it look very basic, they get more honest feedback, because people don't go, oh, well, you know, you've obviously put a lot of work into that, I'd better be nice about it, you know?
Yep.
So really interesting tool, really well thought through. The whole mindset that they've got behind it, of making something that's very low barrier to entry, that's really quick and easy, that you know, is fast and furious, I just think is brilliant. They should use that as their strap line. I'm sure no one's used it before. Okay, you get a 30-day free trial, or if you then decide you want to sign up, so you get to the end of your 30-day free trial, you obviously go, this is amazing, I want to use it. You can then, when you put in your billing information, all the rest of it, if you put in the code BOAG World, that was the old code I just gave you, BOAG World, then you'll get 3 months for free. So you get 30 days for free, and then another 3 months for free, and then you'll start being billed. You can go to sign up and give it a go and all of the rest of those good things at balsamic.cloud, and try it for yourself. It's simple, it's easy, and it's, in my opinion, the best wireframing tool out there. All right, so we come now to our interview for today, which is a slight departure from the theme of the season, though not really, kind of maybe. So we've got a gentleman joining us called Jonathan Courtney. I don't know how my accent's working today, whether I'm going more West Country or less.
Courtney.
Jonathan Courtney, who is an expert in design sprints. So he's done quite an incredible thing. That he runs an agency, and as you'll hear from him in a minute, they decided to focus their entire agency on just running design sprints. They're that big a believer in them. And so I thought, well, let's get him on the show, hear a little bit about his attitude towards design sprints. Because design sprints are something that I found very interesting. If I'm honest, I've got some concerns about design sprints, which kind of I apply, I mention in the interview, but I'll come back to them afterwards as well. But on the other hand, I'm really quite excited about their potential for engaging stakeholders and maybe shifting culture a little bit. So it's a very interesting topic for me. So I was really excited to get Jonathan on the show. So let's listen to what he's got to say, and then we'll have a little chat afterwards. So Jonathan, thank you for being on the show. It's really good to have you here today.
Thanks for having me on here, Paul. I'm excited.
Good stuff. So I think a great place to start, how I'm starting really with everybody, is to get them to say a little bit about themselves and what it is that you do. So let's start with that, if that's okay.
Oh, man, I wish I had a lovely, clean answer to that, but let's get ready for the ramble. So, my job title, I guess what my actual kind of day-to-day work is product strategy. So I'm mm-hmm. going from company to company, helping them figure out what it is they should actually build in the first place. Helping them to figure out, you know, what those user problems actually translate to into in terms of a product, helping their product teams actually work together in a way that actually makes sense. And essentially being a kind of creative problem solver and firefighter for product teams, I would say. It's an awkward explanation, but it's the cleanest I can think of.
That's the trouble these days. Our jobs have all become so complicated, haven't they? We're not always entirely sure what it is exactly we do, or at least to articulate it in a clean way.
Totally.
So give us an idea of some of the kind of clients that you work with, and also the type of, you know, because you, first of all, tell us about the clients you work with. Then I've got a follow-up question about where you're focusing as a business. But let's talk about your clients first.
Right. So the client base is pretty broad in terms of like mm-hmm. the types of organizations we work with. It can be, for example, the UN. We worked with them on a couple of products over the last 4 years. We work with companies like Lego. We work with a lot of Silicon Valley startups. We also help train companies like Slack and Airbnb and Google. So it's as broad as you can possibly imagine.
Wow.
Everything from the Silicon Valley startups to very old, large Fortune 500s and brands. So it's almost every type of company, even the likes of McKinsey and Bain and Company as well.
Oh, crikey. So, I mean, that then brings us on to the interesting thing about you as an agency, because okay, you've got this very broad client base,
yeah.
And most agencies specialize in some way. They either specialize in, you know, in what they're delivering or in the sector that they're aiming at. Now you do specialize in what you're delivering. And quite specifically so, isn't it? So how tell us about that and how it came about.
Yeah. So, I mean, we are really, really aggressively focused on design sprints, to the point that like looking at us from the outside, you might wonder if we do anything else. And honestly, the answer is 90% of our revenue, if not 95%, is coming from running design sprints with our clients. How that happened, I think you'll kind of recognize this problem. We were a standard design agency. We were doing UX, UI, web design development up until 2 years ago. And that was about 4 years into running the company. And I just started to get really sick of these projects. You know, they would always start really interesting. You know, we would start off with a really cool brand and a really cool project. But after about 3 months, there was always this kind of build up of misunderstandings, misalignment, and things would just drag on and on and on. And the projects would, rather than having like a really exciting ending and like, you know, fireworks, they would always sort of fade out. And the client would be fine. They would be like, yeah, great. Okay, talk to you next time. But for us internally at AJ and Smart, it was just like, this doesn't really feel like it's not satisfying. I mean, we can also just go and freelance and we'd have the same experience. And around the same time as that, a lot of the startups we were working with, they couldn't really afford our big company budgets. And so we started breaking down our packages into smaller things. So basically a company would say, hey, we have 10K. And we would say, oh, okay. So that's like maybe like a 2-day workshop and we'll do something for you guys. And that's like how it started organically inside an AJ and Smart. Mm-hmm. And around the same time, the Jake Knapp, the guy who wrote Sprint, he started publishing articles on the Google Ventures website. I was getting really into them. I was like, oh my God, like this is kind of confirming a lot of the things I think about the way I'd like to work. Then I met Jake in January 2016. I was 100% convinced about the design sprint. We decided to quit all of the projects that we were working on, even like huge, giant, you know, half a million euro projects, to start fresh and just work with the design sprint. It was a horrible transition that lasted about 8 months. And now I would say the best thing is that now projects start and end super satisfyingly, and we get to focus on the part of the projects we actually enjoy, which is the strategic starting points. And it's just, I don't know, I just love it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because that's a very narrow, you know, focus to the work that you do.
So, yeah.
For, just for people, there will be some people that actually don't know what design sprints are. So do you want to give us the kind of elevator pitch of what they are, and in particular, why you consider them so beneficial to your clients?
Right. Maybe I should really quickly, just because one of the most common questions I get is like, what's the difference between design thinking and the design sprint? Mm-hmm. I think I'll just really quickly lay that baseline first before I answer it. So the design sprint is derived from a lot of the learnings from design thinking. So design thinking is sort of like a philosophy and a toolkit for, you know, innovation, for user-centered design, for all of these sort of things, but it's very broad, and you can kind of pick and choose how you want to use it and how you want to interpret, you know, a lot of the things that are in design thinking. The design sprint just takes a lot of the learnings from that and turns it into a step-by-step recipe. Mm-hmm. And it's a 5-day step-by-step recipe for starting with something super vague, like, okay, we want to make a new feature that helps people to, you know, onboard a lot easier. That could be like the starting point on a Monday. And by the end of the week, you already have a really high fidelity prototype tested with real users. And you're going through a step-by-step process so that it's kind of almost like foolproof. It's a foolproof way of testing ideas extremely quickly and aggressively. It's not like, it's almost a brute force approach, which causes a lot of people to kind of hate it. Mm-hmm. But we really, really enjoy using it. And it's also not like a tool for everything. There's a lot of cases where it's not worth doing a design sprint, or where a design sprint is not enough. But for the kind of sweet spot, it's a really, really great 5-day step-by-step system for testing products or testing ideas.
So that then raises the question of when you should do a design sprint, and kind of what you can expect to get out of it at the end. So can you kind of enlighten us a little bit on that?
Sure. Yeah, like I said, there's kind of a sweet spot for running a design sprint. I can tell you, first of all, when you shouldn't. I'll show you the two extremes. When you should definitely not do it when it's too small is if you're just doing something related to pure UX. Let's say you're trying to maybe it's like something focused on usability. Let's say we're talking about redesigning a navigation, or thinking about how a page can be laid out, or fixing usability issues, or anything related to anything that could fall under the kind of UX or UI umbrella. That's a little bit too specific. I mean, you can use the design sprint for that, but it might not be worth blocking everyone's time for it, because you need to block a pretty relatively big team. Too broad is then if you just say, hey, we want to innovate, and that's the project, is we want to innovate and we want to create an innovative product. That's a little bit too broad. But the perfect types of projects that I find for the design sprint is when a team says, hey, we've got this product, but we need to dramatically increase the engagement of this product. That's something that you can use the design sprint for, to experiment with a lot of different ways of doing that. Or even a brand new product that doesn't exist, where they say, hey, look, we want to create a digital banking app that focuses on giving people smart insights, but we have no idea how that should look in the first place or what angle we should take with it. That's also a perfect starting point for a design sprint, because you can really just try out a few directions extremely quickly and have something tangible in your hand within 5 days as a starting point for making decisions.
I think that's the key, isn't it? That it's a starting point for, you know, yes, for decision making, because I mean, 5 days isn't very long in order to achieve that a huge amount, especially when you actually read the book on this, that, you know, really only one day is dedicated to full prototyping of what you're going to test.
Yeah.
So does that you know, you talk about, you know, you could do something like, you know, we've got this new product that we're thinking about taking to market. I mean, surely you have, you know, that could be quite a complicated experience. Maybe, you know, even something like an app that you know, has many screens to it or whatever. Yeah. How do you decide what to build and test?
Well, the first like 4 hours of the design sprint on the Monday are all kind of revolving around finding a focus point, right, to so that you're not doing everything. You draw the map and you kind of create a target on the map that you're going to focus on. And often you're trying to focus on the point of the product where the user first finds out about it in the first few minutes of usage. Mm-hmm. So it's generally... I mean, generally what you're trying to find out is not whether this is a well-designed product. You're trying to find out whether this is worth creating in the first place, very often with design sprint. So you don't need to create, you know, 50 screens. Although sometimes, to be honest, now that we've been, I think we've run 235 sprints at this point, and we have two like super crazy good product teams. So sometimes the products are like 50, 55 screens long. Wow. and all created in one day, just because the team is now like so well oiled.
Yeah.
So it is possible, but for normal teams, it's important to have a super, super clear focus with, and we recommend, you know, 10 to 15 screens is kind of the amount you can get done in one day if you want to have something relatively high quality and realistic, because we want to make sure that the prototype is as realistic as possible and that it's not like a paper prototype or wireframes, because we feel like it's harder to get real clear answers from users with those.
So you talk about your product team. I presume, from your agency that you bring into the organization, but you're also going to need people from the organization as well.
Yeah.
So who do you tend to have in the room? How many people are we looking at?
So in total, we want to have about 7 people in the room, 3 people from our side, 4 people from the client side. It's rarely 7 because the client always sends a lot more people. But yeah, we try to keep it under 10. And what we have from the client side is usually the product manager. Well, it depends on the team size, but I'll give you the company size, but I'll give you an average. Product manager, if possible, somebody who's from marketing. If possible, somebody who's from sales or business development. And then usually we want to have a designer from their side as well who can bring a lot of the learnings in-house. Mm-hmm. If the company is small enough, we try to get the CEO in the room or some of the vice presidents as well, because in the end, we want to make sure that we are getting as much buy-in as possible. And honestly, the sprint is, in my opinion, like one of the best ways to like get as much alignment up front as possible. Mm-hmm. And so that, from our side, then we have usually a lead facilitator who is usually a product strategist and product designer, I guess a mixture of kind of UX and UI, but more heavy on the strategy side. Then we will have a UX designer who's then the person who's going to really be the main prototyper. Mm-hmm. And we have a user researcher. And this is something we don't really mention to the clients on our website or anything, but they start 1 week before the sprint interviewing the clients, and gathering as much detail as we can before we start anything at all. So we have a kind of a head start.
Yeah, because you very much have to get up to speed as an agency, one presumes. So that takes time. Now, I mean, the thing that immediately sprung to my mind, especially when you said about getting the CEO or vice president or whatever in the room, it is, you know, getting 20 minutes with these people could be hard sometimes, let alone 5 days. I mean, how the hell do you even begin to broach with anybody, especially within a larger, more traditional organization? We want you to block out 5 days in your calendar.
Yeah, so this is actually, I'm super glad you asked that, because I think any of the people listening right now are going to get and especially anybody who wants to sell the design sprint are going to get a nice piece of information. We only ask that the important people from the client side are in the room with us on Monday and Tuesday.
Right.
And basically AJ and Smart, my company, and the guy who wrote Sprint, we've been updating the Sprint over the last 2 years to the point where now it's so efficient that you just need them in the room for 2 days and then we take over for the next 2 days. So it's already down to 4 days in total for the new version of the design sprint. And even then, it is still difficult to get them in the room for 2 full days uninterrupted, where we don't allow them to check their emails and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is going to sound weird, but one of the ways that we ensure that they stay in the room is that our price is high enough that they feel like it's important enough.
Yeah.
We're not charging like, you know, what we would normally have been charging for design work. We're charging a kind of consulting rate of, I mean, I don't know, I can also tell you for your user or for your listeners, if you want to know the actual how much we charge for this. So we're charging on average 50K per week from our side. And that basically what the client gets then is the three people from AJ and Smart for 4 days for 50K. So it's a premium price for the amount of days that are actually being worked on it.
And is that euros or?
That's euro, yeah. So I don't know what that is.
No, neither do I, but at least people can look it up now, can they?
£45,000, I think. I mean, we work with a lot of companies in Britain as well, and we just charge the same in pounds, actually. So we just charge 50,000 pounds.
And that actually, it makes a huge amount of sense to me, taking that kind of attitude towards it, because it's true. With senior management, they will take the whole experience a lot more seriously if they're paying a lot to do it.
Absolutely.
And it's quite a good way of gauging or helping them not only understand the importance of the process, but understanding the importance of the underlying principles, things like design thinking, things like being user-centric in your approach.
Yes.
You know, all of those, you're kind of upping the value of all of those things in perception as well, I'm guessing.
Totally. I mean, you said something there that was kind of important. A lot of people think that the design sprint is almost like the user research, anti-design thinking approach, because, you know, it's so brute force and you kind of ignore the user a little bit up front. Mm-hmm. But usually it's just a Trojan horse to get people who don't really care about the whole UX thing to, for the first time in their lives, be part of a process where they actually get to see something they've been part of creating being used by real people. And usually after the first design sprint, it's completely unlocked for them and they're super excited to get in touch with people more often and have users using something more often. Because, and that's another thing I would say is like, and I've heard you say this before on your podcast, being able to speak to these people, these stakeholders in a sort of businessy, non-designy way is like super, super important for us. And running them through the sprint shows them that they can do these designy things, but in a very logical, businessy way and have sort of logical businessy outcomes. But at the same time, it's like a Trojan horse and they're kind of hooked after the first one.
I mean, that's like the first time you ever get someone from senior management to sit in on usability testing. There's two aspects I like about this. One is that you get them in front of real users, which is always a game changer. But secondly, you get them to put skin in the game. By them being actively involved in the creation of something, they're actually taking the time to think it through, understand the background of it. So you don't get them swooping and pooping on the project later on some whim that they have, one presumes.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. That was the thing I hated the most about running a design agency 2 years ago. It was like everybody's sitting around at the table for the kickoff meeting. You do a few exercises, you talk a little bit, everybody takes their notes from the agency side. And then I go back to the agency and I tell the designers what we're going to do. And we work together on it for a little bit. And then we go back to the client and they're like, oh yeah, but in the meantime, I saw this cool app and let's maybe like try to go in this direction. And it would just go back and forth and back and forth. And this sort of tension would build up. Whereas now with the design sprint, we don't even offer the client any iteration work. Yeah. Like we just say, here's the prototype. These ideas, a lot of them are from you. And we also drew the storyboard with you, so you know exactly what was going to be in it. And they never even ask for us to make changes. It's crazy. They're just super satisfied at the end of it. And then, of course, they do book more work from us to actually execute the things that came out of the design sprint. And then, you know, we also do what we don't advertise and what we don't talk about, because that's what everyone else does. But we do then help companies then execute that all the way to being on the market. So that's kind of like the design sprint for us is really the most important, where we give the most value. That's why we just kind of ignore all the other stuff unless the client really wants it.
Yeah. I mean, but that's quite interesting then in terms of the clients that are coming to you. That, you know, the majority of clients wouldn't know what a design sprint is if it jumped up and bit them. And of course not, you know, even if they have internal digital teams, a lot of these teams are overworked. Yeah. They don't have time to, you know, keep up on whatever the latest trend is or whatever. And so most agencies will have people coming to them with a design brief. They want to rebuild a website or do whatever. Do you still get that, or do you think the people that are approaching you already kind of understand the value of design thinking and user experience because they're coming to you about a design sprint? What's the makeup?
I'm trying to think about it. I think not a lot of people come to us for the design sprint in the beginning. Usually they contact us because they are like, hey, we need some digital work done on our website, or we need a new app, or we need, and they just say the word innovation and then stop talking.
Yeah.
or they'll say things like, and actually I'd love to talk to you about that maybe another day, because I'm kind of a little bit confused about how to deal with it, but they do call us up and say, hey, we are doing a giant digital transformation project. Yeah. And it's going to go on for the next 2 years, and we need your help. And for us, that usually sets off a warning sign where we're like, yeah, AJ and Smart can't be involved in something like this. Yeah. So we generally, they come to us with something kind of broad, or they just want some product design work done. And then the first time they're exposed to something like the design sprint is when we do the sales call with them. There, maybe that's like 80% of the people, and then 20% of the people come through our YouTube channel or our Instagram, because we're pretty aggressive on all of those platforms in like teaching the design sprint process.
So, I mean, that's interesting then, because that first conversation, when you first talk to them, is quite a hard sell, because, you know, they're coming to you with one thing in their minds, and you're immediately saying, stop doing that. Instead, we want to do this. How do you go about doing that? Because there will be a lot of both internal and external people listening to this show who are thinking they have people coming to them, whether they're stakeholders or clients, saying, you know, here's a brief, go away and build this for me. Mm. How do you stop them going down that line and go, whoa, hang on a minute, what about doing this instead?
Yeah. So the first thing, I think the most important thing, is to just understand what the person who's actually calling you wants personally themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's something that one of our sales coaches kind of thought is, they have their external need, you know, they want this thing to be designed, but they also have their internal need, which is to look good in the company and maybe get a promotion.
Yeah.
So that's always the first thing in my mind. I want to start kind of laying out and figuring out what this person who's talking to me actually wants. And I use that to sort of start talking about the kinds of ways that we would want to work together. And the first thing is, I'll say, look, most people don't enjoy writing briefs. And even if you have one, I'm sure you're kind of worried that you've kind of written it wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they usually have a worry about, because they're creating these briefs. They have to create them because the RFP process is sort of standard across design agencies. But we tell them, you don't need to create any brief for us. We'll create the brief with each other in a one-day workshop before we start the design sprint. So you don't even need to think about it. And that's already the first thing. They're like, oh my God, really? And the second thing is, like, we say, look, here is everything you're telling me. For me, sounds like something that we could get kickstarted by just doing 2 weeks of work. Usually we do a design sprint and then an iteration sprint just to get closer to what they actually want to create.
Yeah.
And then I show them what can be done in 1 week with some case studies that we have internally, and they're usually completely shocked.
Yeah.
They usually say, I thought this would be like a 6 month thing or an 8 month thing. And we're like, no, this is just 2 weeks of work to get things kickstarted. And they kind of start getting excited about it. The only problem is, I guess our biggest problem is procurement.
I was going to say exactly that. Yeah.
Yeah. Our biggest problem. So procure, I'm assuming everyone who listens kind of knows what is that kind of a standard terminology?
You should be fine with that, I would have thought.
Cool. So procurement is our biggest nightmare, because we make our clients pay upfront before the sprint.
Yeah.
All in one go.
Right.
And there's no man days or hours on the invoice. Right. It just says design sprint, 50K, that's it. Yeah. That's all it says.
Yeah.
And so we have to be pretty, we have to be pretty creative working with the procurement department. And the cool thing is, like, most design agencies that I meet, they say that they can't change anything in these procurement departments, and that's just how it has to be. But if you're aggressive enough about it, and you just, like, if the person internally wants you to work there so bad, they'll move heaven and earth to get you through that procurement process, even if you have to use the HR budget instead of the design budget or something like that.
I have just had an incident exactly along those lines where, you know, it's with the UN, actually.
Oh, nice.
I'm invoicing via a third party who's already got a retainer arrangement. Yeah. And, you know, there is always a workaround if people really want to do it. And so, you know, I think that's you have to be aware of that. And of course, the huge advantage of what you're proposing is from the very first conversation, you're differentiating yourself from the crowd. You're taking a different approach. And also you're establishing a peer-to-peer relationship, because they've come to you asking for one thing, and instead of going yes sir, no sir, and going away and building whatever they've asked, you're actually engaging with them as a partner to move towards a solution, and educating you provide more value as well, because you're educating them about best practices as you go along. So
And the other thing is that as soon as we do one design sprint with them, it almost happens every time that somebody in the room, one of the stakeholders, maybe the one person who was the most skeptical about having to be in the room in the first place, after the sprint, they come up to me or they come up to one of the other product designers and they say, I need you to teach my entire company how to do exactly what we did this week.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then our training business kicks in, right? And then we're kind of going from team to team, potentially for years if it's a big company, helping them to improve their processes. So it's really like, I mean, I'm talking about it as if this is a perfect system. We're still an agency. We still have cash flow issues. We're still kind of scrapping around trying to figure out what to do. But it feels really like a very neat package that we've kind of developed now, compared to what we used to have, which was a client calls us and then we figure out what it is that we actually do as a company based on what they want. And now we just say, hey, here's the two things that we do. You can just have those or nothing else.
I think for me, you know, you're looking at it from an agency point of view, which I totally understand. Of course you are. And there will be a lot of people listening to this who are on the agency side. But the reason that I was so keen to have you on this season, as we talk about culture, is it's really what you said earlier, that it's a design sprint is almost like a gateway drug, isn't it? It's an opportunity to start exposing people to that better thinking, that better working methodology and approach that just is so much more effective within a kind of digital realm. The only thing I keep coming back to is that a sprint, you know, if you consider the price that you've just talked about, if you consider the length of the time that you've just talked about, is quite a hard sell. Is there, for want of a better word, is there a kind of gateway drug to the gateway drug, if that makes sense?
Yes. Yes, there is.
Right.
Also glad that you asked that. So there's an exercise called Lightning Decision Jam, which you can Google, and it should be the first article and first video.
Okay.
Which is it's an exercise that's around anything. It's about 1 hour, 45 minutes up to 3 hours, which is essentially taking every single principle in the design sprint and all of the best moments that happen in it and putting it into a super short, super quick exercise that sort of gets across the point of it. And what we generally do is that we go to a company and we'll do this lightning decision jam exercise with the stakeholders on a problem that's been bugging them for a long time, a non-design related problem, usually an organizational or business problem. We on purpose tell them that it should not be design related. Mm-hmm. And out of this really short session, we get some really tangible actions that they can actually do to solve these problems. And they're usually kind of shocked that they managed to do this as a team, because people usually get together to solve problems and it's just a big mess. Everyone's talking at the same time. Nobody actually gets to any conclusions. And this exercise always has a conclusion, always has a bunch of solutions that can be executed on. And this is the exercise that we go to companies and do for free when we want to work with a company. And it's like it honestly works every single, it's like a 100% conversion rate.
Okay. So you've really bigged that up. what goes into it? what do you do in this exercise? I mean, I could just read the post, but you know.
No, it's fine. I can describe it. I literally did it 2 days ago. Actually, one of the things that I do the most is I travel now the world doing this exercise to show these companies how valuable this is. And honestly, I created this exercise just as a way to do retrospectives within AJ and Smart. Actually, I didn't create it myself. It was kind of a team effort. We never expected to use it as a sales tool. But okay, so what you do, you get everyone together. It can be a room with 100 people. It can be a room with 7 people. If it's what 100 people, you generally just split them into smaller groups. If you have a frame for the product, for the problem that we're going to look at, it's always great. So for example, a frame can be communication within company X. That could be the frame, right? Or innovation within company X is a super common one. And then I ask, do you know the sailboat exercise from Agile?
I don't, actually.
It's a really cheesy exercise, and I hate starting with this, but it's kind of really... it's really, really great for teams to get started. So I ask everybody to silently write down 3 post-its of 3 things that are moving them mm-hmm. forward as a company for this topic. So if it is innovation, then it might be willingness to change and really great talent and blah, 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 blah. The important thing is that they write these things without speaking to each other. So the whole point of Lightning Decision Jam is that you don't speak to each other. You do most of the stuff alone, and then it all comes together at the end. That's the same thing with the design sprint. So they stick those positive things up, and they actually present them. So each person says what they wrote, and then there's a good vibe in the room already. So the next step is when it gets more negative. I ask people to spend 6 minutes, one post-it at a time, writing all of the things that are holding them back. By the way, the boat, the sail is moving them forward, and the anchor is moving them back. Yeah. So now I ask them to write for 6 minutes as many things as they can think of that are holding them back. And I make it clear that the results are going to be completely anonymous. So they really should write whatever they want. Just watch out for the handwriting. So after 6 minutes, I ask them to stick up all of the negative things. And there's each team has a big wall of negative things. And then they get some dots. So they each get like 6 dots each, and they silently vote on what problems are for them the biggest problems in their work life. So they start voting on the biggest negative things. Usually there's a pretty a couple of clear patterns. Then we prioritize those problems and we turn them into how might we notes, how might we challenges, which is taken straight from design thinking. And it's also in the design sprint. So just reframing the negative problem as a opportunity, basically. So we have then we take the 3 top voted challenges and we work on those. So how we work on them is we have the how might we stuck on the wall, and then we give everybody 15 minutes to start writing solutions to these challenges alone without speaking to each other again, as many solutions for each challenge as they possibly can. Then they stick those up, they vote on them again silently. And finally, you're left with for each challenge, you're left with a couple of voted up solutions. And these solutions we stick on an effort impact scale so we can see how likely these are, how difficult these challenges or how difficult these solutions would be to execute and how much of an impact they would have. And then we basically assign these tasks, or we turn them into actionable tasks and assign them to people. And the results are usually, it's super simple. It's super basic. It might be difficult to understand when I'm just explaining it by voice. But so at the end, what's happened is that what usually could have been a 3-hour horrible meeting where in the end, most people give up and one loud person keeps talking and talking about their solutions. In the end, everybody on the team has an unbiased way to put their solutions forward, to put their challenges forward anonymously and come out with a generic kind of, not generic, but almost like what the team generally wants to work on. In a way that people don't have to be embarrassed about saying, for example, things come up in companies like, I don't feel respected, or I think like one of our biggest clients, one of the biggest things that came up from all 10 teams at the same time was that the reason we're not going to move forward is because there's such a big fear of failure that we're never going to take chances. And that was such a big... that was such a big moment for the VP of, I think it was like I can't actually remember exactly who it was, but he was just like, oh my God, we need to solve this. We need to do something about this. So that exercise basically then we usually do a 20-minute intro to the design sprint before we do that exercise. And at the end of that exercise, we say, and those are the principles of the design sprint applied to business, like daily life. Imagine that being applied to any of the bigger problems you have within your organization. And then the checkbooks just start flying at us. I don't even know if people use checkbooks anymore, but they just start flying at us anyway. But it really opens the doors because you're really showing the value of it straight up without having to, about how good it is.
That sounds like a great way of leading into the design sprint and a proof of concept that is much more manageable in terms of, you know, time expectations when there's no kind of track record of doing this kind of thing. I love it.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And we also compete with, we are only 20 people here in Berlin. And we're competing with some of the biggest agencies in the world. So we have to, I hear a lot of people saying, you should never do work for free. But I really disagree with that when it can turn into a much bigger project if you do kind of a good job. So we do those lightning decision jams for free every single week all around the world, apart from the flight costs, of course, and stuff like that. But we're all about giving like as much value upfront as possible without charging, because we're pretty confident that they'll see the value and then it will turn into something.
It's always a very good way of engaging with anybody. You know, if you can demonstrate, look, I am so confident this will work, I am willing to do it, you know, to take a hit on it myself. And you can use that same principle internally as well by saying, you know, look, I'll arrange all this. I'll make it all happen. I'll do all the work for it. You just turn up, is kind of the equivalent attitude, isn't it? Which I like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 100% exactly like that. And the cool thing is that the people who call us, let's say it's a product manager or it's usually often these days like head of innovation or something like that. It also makes them look damn good when we come in and when the stakeholders solve these problems. You always see like this moment where the stakeholders are looking at the guy who called us and just like
absolutely.
Nodding with a smile.
Yeah, I love that feeling too. You've got the same kind of enthusiasm that I do over stuff like that. It's a great moment. This kind of gateway to the gateway. Is there any kind of, I'm not going to get you to explain what a sprint is in terms of the process or anything like that, but is there any kind of top tips for those people considering running a sprint for the first time? You know, they've read the book, they've done anything. Is there anything that's not in there that you think, oh, it's really useful to know that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll give you, how much time do I have? Because I'd love to give like three of my favorite tips before you run a design sprint. Okay. You can just tell me if I'm going on too long. okay. So my number one tip for doing your first design sprint, or even if it's not your first design sprint, just for absolutely nailing it, is to make sure you have an idea of the first few exercises of the sprint before you go into it. So let's say you're facilitating. The first exercises of the sprint are the expert interviews, the map, the long-term goal sprint questions, and lightning demos. Those are all happening on the Monday of the Design Sprint 2.0, which you can find everywhere online. And if the week before, what we always do at AJ and Smart, and it's a game changer, is we contact the client, we interview them, but we're not just gathering random data that we can dump then, on the Monday. We're actually specifically trying to fill out those exercises 1 week before for ourselves. So we're trying to figure out what could the map look like? What could these how might we's look like in the expert interviews? What kind of long-term goals might come up in the sprint? And one super important one is an exercise called lightning demos, where you ask the group of people that you're working with to find some examples of products and services from outside the current industry you're working in that could help give us some inspiration for the kind of product that we want to work on. And so usually we find a couple of those ourselves as well the week before. Like, we try to find the best ones so that we can really, really impress the client and get them super excited about what we're working on. Because usually you want to be, if you're the client, if you're the agency, you just want to kind of have the best stuff to show them. And the cool thing is, if you start the sprint on the Monday, The Monday is the like one of the worst parts of the sprint. You have to gain the trust of these people who usually don't believe that it's going to work. And you have to do that very, very quickly. So if you already have a few of the potential answers up your sleeve, even though they won't be the final answers, it's a way that you can actually start the process and not like already start with some momentum. So one of the problems we used to have the first like year running the sprint was we always got stuck on an exercise called the map. So we would be standing around with the client for like 2 hours trying to draw this map. It was a nightmare and it killed the momentum. It killed the motivation. And it also, it kind of poisoned the well for the rest of the day. It killed the vibe and they had less trust in us. And now before we go into the sprint, the people from AJ and Smart, we all look at what we think the map might be. So when that exercise comes up, we already can start drawing it in front of the client and say, so here's what we think that might look like. Okay. And this is stuff that's not recommended to do in the design sprint book, but it's been a huge, huge game changer for us. So that's tip number one and maybe the longest one. Okay. Maybe I'll just give you two of the main tips because the second one's also super important. Tip number two is that there's always going to be a troublemaker in the room and you need to already, you have to be ready to deal with them before the sprint starts or you're going to lose the trust of the team. You're going to panic and maybe the results aren't going to be as good at the end. And how you deal with that is by constantly setting expectations before each exercise, before the sprint even starts and during the whole day. And there are a couple of things that you can be guaranteed that will happen if you don't set the expectation. Number one, people will tell you that it's moving too fast and they're losing ideas. So if you say at the very start of the day, this is going to feel like it's moving too fast. It's going to feel like we're losing ideas. It's even going to feel like sometimes your ideas and the things you want to say are being a little bit disrespected because we're just flying past it. But I want you to trust the process. I want you to know that this is normal. I want you to know that I've run this many times before. And I want you to know that that is completely part of the process for it to feel too fast. Often as well, there's a couple of exercises in there that don't feel like they're connected to the bigger picture. There's an exercise called Crazy Eights. And almost every time when people are doing it, they have two things in their mind. And it's number one, I don't see how this is connected to everything else. And number two, I don't have any ideas yet, so I can't do this exercise. So we always say, don't worry. If at this point you don't feel like you have any ideas, that's no problem. The system works with or without your ideas. And also this exercise may feel a little bit disconnected from the rest of them. And this is like a, because what happens is if someone puts up their hand, if the stakeholder or the CEO puts up their hand and says, look, I don't see the point of this, or look, I feel like I'm losing my ideas. Everyone in the room is feeling that as well, because you haven't said it and people start to turn against you. So you need to really, really be setting the expectations in the beginning and exaggerating as well. Tell them it's going to feel tiring. Tell them it's going to be hard to get through. And usually that stops people from causing trouble in the first place because they kind of will feel stupid bringing that up, even though you're constantly
spot on. I mean, I do that in all kinds of situations, not just on something like a design sprint. That idea of preempting common objections where you know that they're going to come up, because it makes you look in control. It means it shows that you've done this a lot before and you know what's coming and, you know, all the rest of it.
Just one more tiny one is, if it's your first time around, or even if it's not your first time around, I would recommend at this point searching for. So read the book for sure. I hope everyone buys Jake's book. I don't get anything for you buying his book, but I like him. But I think you should also definitely search Design Sprint 2.0 on Google and just watch some of the videos there, because there's a lot of changes that have happened in the last 2 years that we haven't had a chance to put into a book format yet. But we've tried to put some videos together and there's a lot of stuff in there that make the exercises more foolproof and less likely to fall apart under pressure.
I was going to ask you exactly that, where people can find out more, because you've got a YouTube channel, haven't you, that I noticed comes up as soon as you type in Design Sprint 2.0. So people shouldn't have a problem finding you. But what is it in case they need to?
Smart. Yeah, it's AJ and Smart. So just AJ. It's just AJ and Smart, but really almost any design sprint question you have, if you type that into Google, you're going to find us.
Good.
We're pretty wild on the whole design sprint.
That's actually brilliant.
Thing.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming on the show. Loads for people to check out. And hopefully that can be an exercise that helps to shift the culture within your organization. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Paul. Bye-bye.
So there you go. That's Jonathan on design sprints. All of the things that he referenced in the show in terms of things like the Lightning Decision Jam and Design Sprint 2.0 and all the rest of it, I'll include in the show notes so you can check those out. Marcus, what did you think of, how did that leave you feeling about design sprints? And is it something you thought much about before?
I guess to a lesser extent, we do that a bit. But the first thing I want to say is that's my favourite interview of the season so far.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that one. I think it's because it's more kind of, I can relate to it more. I think, and also he's very engaging, etc. But with regard to the design sprints, yeah, I thought that being brave enough to kind of say that's what we want to do and we're only going to offer that, even though he did say later that they're keen to execute the work as well, which was
the only
slight negative. But it was an incredibly brave thing to do, and obviously because nobody else is really doing it in the way that they're doing it, they're being incredibly successful at it. The obviously, I think the main advantage of doing it is that you get senior people in the room.
Yeah,
from day one. I mean, I've said a few times while I was listening to it, what about the users? What about the users? But that can come later, as he said. What you want to do is ensure that you've got real, true buy-in. If you get that, then all the other things that you've been talking about for years about, you know, digital transformation and that kind of thing, that will come afterwards. As we've said earlier on in this particular season, it doesn't happen unless you've got buy-in from the top.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I mean, particularly the IBM interview we did, you know, all of their change happened with the new CEO.
Yeah.
And that, I suppose to a certain extent, that happened differently with them. But, you know, if you get somebody like AJ and Smart in to do these sessions, then you're going to be educating the people that can make real change happen. So that's their major advantage, I thought, listening to it.
The thing that I couldn't get past mine and is this... To get those kinds of senior people in the room is major effort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is very difficult to do.
Well,
and I know he said in part, you know, well, we don't have them in for the whole week.
Mm.
And then that began to, I then found myself going, well, are you going to get that level of buy-in that you need to for having them for the short time? But even getting middle management, you know, to sit in a room for a whole week seems like a stretch. And that is the one thing that I couldn't get past. He talked about the doing the Lightning Decision Jam when I was talking about the gateway drug to the gateway drug all of that. And that made sense to me. I got it. He's obviously better at persuading people of this kind of stuff than I am, is all that I can conclude.
Well, and the fact that they're expensive, you know.
I mean,
he said it's going to cost you $50,000 for 1 week and a little bit of research prior to that. And then they're dying to do another week. And then and then we'll help them execute. I mean, so we're into seriously big budget stuff. And as he's made the point, there's no better way of getting senior management's attention. So,
yeah.
But you've got to have an excellent product and be incredibly persuasive as well, which he obviously is. So
I was going to go, you have to have big balls.
Yes, indeed. Yes. But one
thing, but you are right.
The point that he made, maybe that people might have missed a little bit, was make the client look good and how important that is. I mean, we've been working with a particular client for years who told us in no uncertain terms early on that this will work if you make me look good, and it's so true.
Yeah,
because, you know, because then therefore they will get. You know, if they're looking good internally to their bosses, then, you know, all the things that you want to happen during the project are much more likely to happen than if they're struggling internally. So it's so important.
Yeah. It was a very interesting interview. There was a lot in there that I find fascinating. I've got to be honest, I've not got to run a full 5-day design sprint yet. I obviously need to up my sales pitch for it, because it's not something I've succeeded to do. And I would very much like to do it, although it does strike me as blooming hard work.
Oh yeah, well, we all know what just doing a day's workshop. I mean, when we work with our American clients, we always do at least 3 days in a row, and at the end of that, I can hardly walk.
Knackered. Yeah,
let alone speak. But
I mean, this is if you know because obviously I've done things of this. It is at a lower level of activity. You know, it's not a kind of nine to five. It's a 10 to 4 kind of thing. But even so, it's still a lot of work. It's still very tiring and very intense. So, which he said as much, didn't he?
Yeah.
Anyway, right, let's talk about our second sponsor for today, which is Full Story. We've had the best wireframing tool with Balsamiq. We've also got the best session recorder, in my opinion, with Full Story. Really, you know, one of the things that I love about this show is that I get to pick and choose a little bit which sponsors I have and which ones I don't. There are many, trust me, many that I turn away. But Full Story would never be one of those. It's an absolutely brilliant tool that I personally use. I've learned so much from using Full Story. Even on, obviously I've used it on client sites before, but I even use it on my own site from time to time. I don't run it the whole time. But when I'm trying to find out a particular thing, I will run it for a while on my site so that I can discover what problems I'm experiencing. So, I mean, I used Full Story, and it was absolutely instrumental in me reducing my bounce rate, because bounce rates on blogs tend to be very high. And so I ran Full Story for a little bit, and I found some really interesting things about how people were moving around the site, you know, how they were engaging with blog posts, and it altered the way that I write the blog post. It altered the way that I inserted links to other blog posts. So, for example, I was discovering that a lot of users, as you would expect, weren't. You know, getting to the end of a post. So all of those related posts that I had at the end, people weren't seeing. So I started to embed them within the post itself. I did a whole load of changes based on just watching user sessions on the website. And I was able to decrease the bounce rate on my blog by over 5%, which I was over the moon with. It's also got incredibly powerful search facilities built into it, which is really useful for kind of narrowing down just the kind of sessions that I wanted to watch. So, you know, obviously I could say, well, I want to see sessions that have only, you know, where they've only viewed one page. But I could even go down and say, you know, I only want to see sessions that are one page where someone has, scrolled for this length of the page or whatever else. You could do all kinds of really clever stuff. If you're a visual person like me, you probably struggle with analytics. I mean, you get someone like Chris Scott that absolutely eats up analytics and can find out all these amazing things from it. I personally find analytics quite hard. But if you're like that and you're more of a visual person, then something like Full Story is absolutely invaluable for discovering stuff. You can sign up for free today and you get a month of their pro account absolutely free. There's no need to enter a credit card or anything like that. If you still want to kind of continue to use it after your trial, but you can't quite justify the price, then you can get up to 1,000 sessions per month free anyway on an ongoing basis, which for me and my blog is absolutely enough for me to be able to do kind of periodic little tests. And then basically I get to try it, you know, try it out and trial it and work with it. And that means that I can recommend it to clients later who pay money, and I know my way around it. So that's why I guess they do the 1,000 sessions a month is for people like me. Anyway, if you want to give it a go, then try it out at fullstory.com/Boag. And that's pretty much it. Marcus, what do you have for us in terms of a joke today?
This one's from Aslan.
Aslan.
Right, who's been on the show before.
Yes.
it's so bad, it's brilliant. I forgot to put blueberries in the little cakes I sold at the big Alpine slalom race. But it doesn't really matter in the grand ski muffins.
Oh, that is the worst joke I think we've had on the podcast. That is remarkably
Grand
bad.
Muffins, that's fantastic. Come on.
Oh, Aslan. You feel that that's so bad he made it up himself. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
yes, exactly. There's quite a lot in the Bad Jokes channel on the Black Burglars Back channel that you know they've made up themselves. But yeah. That one, yeah, as I said, I introduced it in it so bad, it is brilliant. So,
yes.
There you go.
Well done, Aslan. Thank you very much. Okay, that about wraps it up for this show. Thank you very much for joining us, guys, and we'll be back again next week. Goodbye.
Bye.